Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
It is Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson. It's been ages since I've done one of these, not least because Liverpool haven't played a ton of football matches recently. We'll be talking about that in a second or two. We will also be speaking to Robbie O'Neill, Sean Rogers, and Sean Bennett in a little bit of a mini overview show about the nature of this massive week Liverpool have got coming up and looking ahead to Manchester City. Andy Heaton spoken to David John Jags from the Ragamuffins, who's performing with the Northern Soul Train at the Flory as part of Flory Food Aid this Saturday on the bill that includes Mick Head. That is to come too. Looking forward to that one as well. And Harriet Pryor spoke to a psychotherapist, Trevor Gray, who works with many an athlete about performance. Lots of interesting stuff coming up for you on Tour Live this week. But we will start off with a shout out for our Jürgen documentary. Do check it out. All five parts are now available if you haven't had the chance to do so already. And obviously with the fact that the football is back, our football is back, the football proper is back. I will start it off by saying about the thing that struck me. We do all the shows on the Anfield Wrap. If you subscribe, we do a show called The Friday Show. That's a Premier League preview show, Robbie. And when I was doing, pulling together the agenda for Friday's show yesterday, I suddenly realised that if Newcastle win on Sunday, no matter what happens with any other results, if Newcastle win on Sunday, they just go above United. They will just go above Manchester United. And we've been talking about this top four race as though it's only one place, Robbie. But the idea that if Newcastle win, they go above United, it strikes me as rather mad.
Yeah, they've dug in there, Newcastle, because I think over the last couple of months in particular, or last 6 weeks rather, the much anticipated blip came. And, you know, they're still there or thereabouts, aren't they? I think they won the last game before the international break, didn't they? And
yeah, they won the last two before the international break.
Yeah, and I think they really ground, I think there was one I remember in particular, they really ground the results out. I can't remember which one off the top of my head. And I think, As you say, two places. If there are two places there, I suppose it makes it a much more kind of like, I don't know if that makes it an easier task for Liverpool or an harder one generally, because after the United game, obviously I think a lot of people thought we could actually overtake them, but then our form since then obviously hasn't been great. But with the resets and, you know, with two places up for grabs, and also with kind of people having to play each other and people taking points off each other, it just makes the old picture a lot more easier for us to navigate, I suppose.
I think that's one of the key things about it, Sean. I mean, I'll just run through, and it's, you know, it's a mad run of fixtures. Newcastle play United on Sunday. Then midweek, Newcastle go to West Ham. Man United then have got Brentford at home. Then Man United have got Everton at home. And then Brentford play Newcastle. I mean, Brentford are just in there and about. It's worth remembering they're a top half sides as well. And in fact, Brighton and Brentford play each other this weekend as part of all of this. You know, Robbie says that about Newcastle. Newcastle win the last 2 weeks, but United only take 1 point from those two games because we beat them 7-0. And then they drew 0-0 with Southampton. And it's easy for a home. It's easy for sides to, for everyone to end up caught up in this. It suddenly looks a bit like almost the relegation picture where it's so compressed. And that's why I think from Liverpool's point of view, all we can do is look after ourselves, Sean. But everyone else, they're all capable of dropping points. And I think we should be seeing it as two places that could be available.
Yes, very much so. I think, I don't know about the others. I know United have got a fairly easy run-in of run-ins, potentially. But then you don't know what state they go into at that point, what tournaments they might still be in, fixture congestion and the like. And certainly, it's quite good for Liverpool, I think, for a load of different reasons to have these games in the space of a week now. But I think it's really important to have them now as well, because then all of a sudden, when you look at everyone picking up points off everyone over the next week or two outside of Liverpool, it doesn't half make our fixture look a lot easier, which means nothing with this particular Liverpool side. But yes, very much it United, third and fourth, looks available. Obviously, Tottenham have played two games more. So it's worth saying that everyone's got games in hand on them. Maybe for the teams with fixture congestion, maybe like Brighton, you'd rather be in Tottenham's position with the points in the bag, of course. Yeah, I don't think Brentford and Brighton, but particularly Brighton, I don't think they're potentially a threat on it, because I just think the FA Cup is enormous for them. And if they're not resting and rotating for the FA Cup, I think they're doing it wrong. And with a fair win, they should qualify for Europe, I think, anyway. And in terms of the top four race, I don't think Newcastle are that big a threat either, myself, because I just think when you're on a run in, the ability to cruise through games with and ultimately to score your way out of trouble sometimes and to go 2-0 ahead as early as possible is really important. And I think when you're living games on a knife edge of a goal with the additional nerves and stress, and then when you add in that so many teams in the league have got something to fight for.
Yes, this more than anything.
Thinking that you're going to win every boxing fight on points and do 12 rounds, grueling. I just don't see that as being a big threat. I'd be more concerned about Tottenham than I would be about Newcastle.
With it, Sean, he mentions Tottenham there. You know, if Brighton are in this, Brighton have got Brighton and Brentford this weekend, then they go to Bournemouth midweek. And then next weekend, Brighton go to Tottenham. And in the meantime, Everton play Tottenham. We feel like our games are massive games, and they are. But with them each being against City, two of them being against City and Arsenal, and Chelsea, you certainly don't feel like they're in it at this point. The really odd thing is, whilst, you know, I don't think it would be brilliant to win all three, but we can say we may well drop points in one of them. The thing to point out is because everybody else is playing everybody else, not everybody can win. And that, to me, in a way, sort of takes the pressure off a little bit. You know, you can feel as though you don't want to be looking at the end of this week and looking at the table and thinking, oh, God, it's, you know, everyone's got away from us. Everyone can't get away from us because not everyone can win because they're all playing each other. And suddenly looking at the fixtures in that context, it gives it a whole new light.
Now, I do have to say, I'm not even looking up at this rate. I'm looking behind a news level, which is a really sad point to be at. But as you said before, it's so compressed. Like, it wasn't until I looked at the table before and I'm thinking, God, are we even going to get Europa League here? Like, that would actually be a win from the season. You've got three of us on 42. Brighton, as you say, you've got the game in hand and a decent run coming up. So I'm more... you know, I guess that on the flip side, if we beat City, Man United beat Newcastle, then we're what, two off fifth, three off fourth, which is mad to think how close we are, but how bad we are simultaneously. This league is just the season is just really, really messing with my mind. What do you expect from him?
It's the full league though, Sean, and one of the reasons why, and I think we get stung with it at Bournemouth, but I think Newcastle got stung with it at Bournemouth as well. They drew 1-1. One of the problems is no one's taking it easy. You've got Chelsea draw 2-2 with Everton, haven't gone ahead twice, but Everton feel like there's still something in it for them, Sean. You've got every game matters to everyone. Every minute of every game is mattering, and Liverpool need to get their heads in that. I'd argue that, you know, it's very possible that Newcastle, Manchester United and Tottenham need to get their heads in a bit more as well. But I think that's the key thing here. Every game, it's not just this. No one's going to take it easy. And I think that's what we've just got to accept. Both against Manchester City and when we go to Leeds, no one is going to take it easy. You're going to have to be on it or you're going to get punished.
Like when you're looking as low as what, 10th and 11th for Chelsea and Villa, who could still very feasibly catch us. When I'm looking into the next three, I'm thinking if we're still there or thereabouts in sixth, I think we'll have come out with a really good run out of that three. I mean, I'd take four out of six. I'd be delighted with four out of nine. Yeah, maybe five out of nine from the next three, but I just want us to still be in with that shout because it could be a really realistic position to be dropping down into ninth or tenth, and then I think we are in real danger.
I think within it, Robbie, we've got to find our way to do our thing, but all these other games do matter. And when you play teams matters, you can, you know, it's happened in seasons gone by. Whilst it's like this, the league, then every game will feel like, you know, everyone will be scrapping for absolutely everything in every second. And I think that, you know, we're not even here. I've mentioned there, Brentford are playing everyone. And Brentford will have an eye on a European place as well, as much as anybody else. They've got every right to. They'll have an eye on a European place. So Brentford have got big games coming up now where they're playing all the teams around them in 1 week, just like we sort of perceive ourselves to be. You know, they are playing up against, you know, they've got Brighton, they've got Man United, and they've got Newcastle. They're all theoretically in touching distance of. And I think we've not seen anything like this before. We've got to, I think the sides that understand that best from here until the end of the season, what this actually is, and deal with it. Because the manager talks today about dealing with setbacks. And I think the sides that deal with setbacks best, both within games and also on a game-to-game basis? Who keeps the nerve is, I think, a massive defining thing this season.
I think that's a really good point. And I think, actually, in a way, our problem's been almost the reverse, because I feel like every time things have gone our way this season, for instance, we'll put 7, 8, 9 goals past the team. Next week, we'll run out and throw a stinker. So, like, the best time to play Liverpool is, in a way, when they're full of their own hubris, when they're full of confidence, because they're actually then, they kind of, like, they're naive to their own frailties. So, I suppose it's one of those, if you can get your head in the game a bit, and if you can box clever, you're away. I don't know, is the, because we're the early kickoff tomorrow, aren't we? We're the 12. I think even for us, like, I know historically we're not great with early kickoffs, but I mean, I don't know what Man City's record is at the Etihad with half 12, but I don't think there's any team out there that enjoys an early kickoff. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's
about timing of fixtures when they fall. Is there anyone else? I think I know United are doing the Thursday Sunday cycle, aren't they, at the moment?
Yeah.
So how's that going to catch up with them as the season progresses, things like that? I think you're absolutely right. Every single team's got their own kind of like fixture pattern and their own priorities with which to deal with. I've said this quite a lot about Liverpool this season, and I think at some point it is going to come through. This Liverpool team has experience in abundance. It has experience in abundance. And okay, this season they haven't responded brilliantly to setbacks, but this is also a Liverpool team that lost out on a European Cup final and went and won it the following year. This is also a Liverpool team that lost out on the league title by a point and then went and won it by 17, 18 points the following year. So this Liverpool team, in the meta, can deal with setbacks. It's just got to remember that. And I don't know what's going on a sports psychology basis at the club, but if you can get it into their heads that they are worthy and they are capable, they'll be absolutely fine.
Them feeling as though they are worthy and worthy of one another, Sean. You know, for me, I noticed today when it was pointed out about the record against the top six versus the record at the bottom, I don't feel like this is a Liverpool team that doesn't want it or lacks motivation. For me, it looks like a Liverpool team that's allowing itself to get disheartened and is allowing itself to, and maybe at times not actually being set up with proper preparation for some of these games because of question marks around injuries, question marks about looking after players moving forward. I think it's a bit patronising to think they're not trying hard. I think they are trying hard. I think it's when things aren't working structurally, they're really doing their own heads in and they're doing each other's heads in. And that's why I think they've got to, you know, this is a team, when Robbie talks about those successes, one of the things I think, though, is this is a team that nailed the running in the COVID season when they had Nat Phillips and Reece Williams at centre-half. And God love the pair of them. You know, Liverpool go all 10 unbeaten, but the two of them were making 5 mistakes a game. But what was happening was everyone was digging everyone else out. The way it feels at the minute is one person makes a mistake and it feels to me like they're either on their own back or everyone's on each other's back. And I think that's the way they've got to deal better with setbacks. They've got to look after each other a bit more. They've got to back each other up a bit more. They've got to talk each other up a bit more during matches and not get on each other's nerves.
Yes, they definitely, you need certainty of structure, I think. And it helps with bravery to have certainty of safety as well. And this Liverpool team have been exceptional to do what they've done. They've had to walk the tightrope. And I think what you've just referenced there, when you have to put Nat Phillips and Reece Williams in, you go, okay, there's an expectation management without anyone even to have a discussion about it at that point. And then everyone goes into sort of covering everybody, I guess, in that regard. And there's also certainty of the aim at that point. You can buckle down. I do think it's really difficult for a team that has aspirations of winning the league to then rouse itself for a top four race. I do think it's fair that maybe takes some time to assimilate to. I think that Liverpool defensively, and when Liverpool have had possession of the ball, we've been on too much of a tightrope. And I also think that this Liverpool team and squad and manager, you know, metaphorically speaking, aren't ones to be like Ocean's 11 going through, you know, Pep Guardiola style, the plans to rob the bank, using every little tool to go through. we're a bit like an action movie where we're the rock and we go through the front of the house in a Mustang and there's flames and everything going. And I just think at Anfield at times against lower sides in the league and higher sides in the league, we've seen periods where Liverpool have wanted to just go at an intensity and at a pace at times without thinking to a degree. And they've just brought that pace and intensity. I think one of the problems, particularly away from home, is that I think Liverpool have been far too passive. And at times the structure has meant that it's too easy to basically just break down the sides of the centre halves. There's too much of a tightrope with the way that we want to. It's been too philosophical for me in terms of going, we'll just play out with the two. You're not good enough to get it off us. We'll dominate the middle of the park. We'll play through you, and then we'll get at you in the sort of final third. And I think that's why you've seen in so many of our away games just sterile possession, side to side, not really feeling like you're going to create too many chances, and the opposition get mega comfort from that. And I think Liverpool have got to tweak the structure and tweak a few things. But in terms of what I want to see out of this, is Liverpool in the tunnel just staring at the opposition going, no matter what happens, we're both coming out of this with black eyes, broken bodies. We're going to run you all over the pitch. We're willing to die now. And I think Liverpool have got to get that foot of the field, not just for now, but I think for next season as well. And there's no other reasons why they can't do that, but they all look like the boardroom being sick of the sight of each other. And I think even if it results a draw or Liverpool defeat, they've all just got to enjoy the process a bit more. And I think this break couldn't have come at a better time to possibly help Liverpool do that.
As part of all of that, Sean, you know, mentioned before about where the other sides are, you know, Spurs, it's worth pointing out, Conte's gone. Newcastle have had the blow of the cup run. Man United have got a sense of togetherness, but they've just lost Casemiro for 4 games. There's a couple of injuries beginning to loom around the squad, and they've got tons and tons of games on the horizon in there as well. Brighton look like they're in good nick, but there is a course and distance thing. I think we've got to not get too carried away about the qualities of our opponents. And when we're thinking about these setbacks, we've just got to go, it's okay. It's okay, because we're not trying to deal with Pique or Pep Guardiola, Manchester City anymore. We need to accept where we are, I think, Sean, and build from there, one foot in front of the other.
Yeah, and I think talking about setbacks, a lot of focus is going to go on the defence and some of the shaky moments we've had. But if you're looking at the past few games, the margins have been fine. And what I'm looking at this game is the front three or the front four potentially to really step up now. You know, we haven't scored in our last two. We've only scored 13 and 13 away games. Yeah. We haven't scored in our last four or five away games. You're looking at the likes of Jota, who's really due a goal. So for me, when I'm thinking about reactions, is not just kind of looking at the back and, you know, pointing fingers. It's actually the front three stepping up, because in the seasons where we've done so well, going 1-0 down
away from home, especially, Sean, isn't it? It's away from home, especially.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, going 1-0 down, the mantra and the mindset of, especially watching the game, is thinking that sounds, we'll just outscore you then. And I'm not really getting that. I'm not really getting that feeling, especially on the road this season. So that's a psychological side I'd really like to see.
We'll come back and talk about this game coming up against Manchester City in a few minutes if you're on tour live, and then we go from there. Just to let it, coming up now, we've got Harry Pryor speaking to psychotherapist Trevor Gray. Now, he mentions Hillsborough and Heysel, so do be aware on that. If you don't fancy listening to that right now, that's perfectly reasonable. It makes a ton of sense, but he does mention it in there that the conversation is about other matters. Harry Pryor with Trevor Gray. And then after that, it's Andy Heaton speaking to David John Jags from the Ragamuffins, who is performing at the Floddy Food Aid thing on the bill that is with Mick Head. The event is sold out, but you can donate online at www.theflorry.org. That is coming up after then. This is Tour Live. We'll take our little break. Those two things are coming, and then we'll be back.
Brilliant. So, Trevor, thanks for joining us for Tour Live. Just first of all, introduce yourself a little bit and tell us about what you do and your background.
Okay. Well, these days I'm what we would call a performance psychotherapist. So I work with people in performers, either in sports or the performing arts. So it's everything from footballers and athletics, you know, athletes, gymnasts, swimmers, rowers, and then on the performing arts, loads of actors, musicians, TV presenters, even now an orchestral conductor, one of my recent clients. So anybody involved in performance, I kind of work with them very different to a psychologist who would work, if you like, with the athletes. I work with the person. So I'm interested in what you're like, what your hopes and dreams are, what your fears are, what your feelings and emotions are. So much more kind of personal stuff, if you like, than psychologists do.
Yeah, and you spent, let's talk a bit about your journey to kind of getting to that point where you are now. You spent most of your early career in music, didn't you? So can you tell us a bit about that and your background in music?
Well, I'm I don't know, you tell my accent's that kind of, you know, twisted and calmed down now. But I left Liverpool when I was 18, born in Walton, lived in Aintree, and went down to London to do a philosophy degree. And then music was my first love. I'm a cliche scouser in that music and football are the only two things I'm really, really interested in. I was better a musician than I was a footballer. So I got into music. And a couple of mates at school, we formed a band called Apollo 440. And we got signed to CBS, Sony Records, and top 10 hits and Top of the Pops and all those things, and toured around the world and played with people like Jean-Michel Jarre and Jeff Beck, and, you know, made records with the likes of U2 and Frankie Goes to Hollywood and all sorts of people as well. So I did that for probably 20 years, got kind of bored with that, got into football, basically because my son started playing football. And they needed a coach one day. So I was like, oh, yeah, I can play football. I'll do a bit of that. And thought, I like this. Did my coaching badges. Got involved with a local semi-pro club. And then got spotted by Fulham. And so I was a youth coach for Fulham for a few years until I fell out with them because I didn't feel that they were really looking after their players and their kind of youth academy boys properly. So I then set up my own soccer school that we went around the country, basically working with players that have been released from clubs and rehabilitating them and training them. We hired places like Bisham Abbey and had courses there. We put 100 boys back into the system, 11 to 16 year olds, and they went to places like Spurs and Man U, but also to small places like York and Yeovil and Ipswich and places like that. And then I found that I was becoming the dream factory. I was becoming the place that people went to kind of make them a star. And it's like, no, this is not what it's about. It's about rehab. And we'd already done a 10-part TV series about my soccer school that had been shown on telly. So I became the dream factory. Didn't want to do that. And I was thinking, right, I need to. What intrigued me actually was the mental side of it all, as opposed to it's easy if you like to teach people how to play in a back four or back five or how to, you know, close people down, how to press, all that stuff. To me, that's kind of easy. It's the mental stuff. It's the what's the difference between makes somebody kind of punch above their weight, if you like, or not, yeah, psychologically. So I got involved. I wanted to be a sports psychologist, and somebody said to me, "No, you're too personal. Do you want to be a psychotherapist? Do you want to be somebody who talks to the person?" So I investigated that. Did my 4 years training about 10 years ago, and this is what I've been doing ever since, and loving it.
Yeah, and you mentioned there something that's interesting, and that's players that get dropped and then kind of find their way out of the system and don't really know where to go and what their next move is. And do you think that's improved over the last few years? And there's been more focus on it, hasn't there, especially in the media? But is that something you still see as a common problem working with the athletes that you do?
It still is a common problem. It's better than it was. It was terrible. You know, I've got loads of horror stories that I could tell you about, but you know, players absolutely getting dropped. But recently, even American football player, I was dealing with English guy who went to America, did very well. He had two injuries. Basically, after the first injury on his foot, they were pressuring him. He was going to be in the first draft. He's like 20 years old. And they were like, you know, are you fit? You've got to be on it. We've got other people who want your gig. So he came back too early, made it worse, broke it, was dropped like a bomb. And he was just about to sign, he said, £1 million deal. So yes, that kind of care for young athletes is still missing. I believe the football's getting better. I mean, there didn't used to be what they used to call exit strategies. The bigger clubs now are a little bit better on that, are kind of feeding them down to smaller clubs.
Yeah.
But it is still a factory. That's not a mistake. It's still a football factory. This is still kids being produced. It's a meat industry. One of the things when I was, you know, professionally working in the game was, you know, people were talking about, yes, trawling clubs was what they called it. we need to trawl the youth clubs to find players, get as many as we can and find the diamonds, and then we can kind of polish them up. But all those clubs are, you know, they have squads of 20, 30 people. They're only interested in one or two players. Everybody else is collateral damage. And they're there. And these kids, you know, up to 16 years old, even 18, think they're going to be footballers and don't do well at school and all these things. And it's and then they get dropped and their world falls apart.
Yeah, I want to talk a bit about your background and how that kind of influenced you in wanting to go into this field. You mentioned when we chatted before about being a Liverpool fan and being present at Hillsborough and kind of how that's impacted your life and how that made you kind of interested in helping others. So can you tell us a bit about that story and that side of things?
Well, I was at Heysel as well as Hillsborough. I was 19 years old at Heysel. Got split up from my brother. Me and my brother were at the game. And going in, there was such chaos outside that we got split up into different places. And I ended up in Section Z, which was the section where the wall fell. So, yeah, we were very, very much, you know, there. At Hillsborough, we were there with my brother and my dad, in the stands. So we could see, you know, we got there very early. My dad in his kind of advancing years, we wanted to get there and see the build-up. And we could see, you know, already an hour before kickoff again, that the middle was full and that the outside's, you know, familiar story that everybody knows. Both those events, you know, did have a massive effect on me. And the idea of PTSD, the idea of helping people, the idea of talking and sharing, it's definitely something that I kind of found. You know, I did 5 years in therapy myself, you know, exactly talking about things like Heysel and Hillsborough, you know, very close to my heart and very close to my heart when people talk about traumas and things that happen to them that I'm, you know, yeah, I can get my head around where they're coming from.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing that. So how long was the gap between these things happening in your life and then you deciding that you wanted to go on your journey to be a psychotherapist and help others?
Well, they're not the only events in my life where things have kind of gone wrong. I won't go into some of those things. That's between me and my therapist. And as I say, I was a teenager at Heysel. And I guess the thing was, and even in those days, was you don't talk about it. You deal with it. Shut up. It'll go, you know, if you don't look at it, if you don't approach it, if you don't, you know, find out more about it, then it'll just go away and you don't need to deal with those emotions and those feelings. I think when you do get into it, that's how you can kind of move to the next stage. And certainly in the thought of me helping other people, then I needed to get through to the next stage. So I needed to go to therapy for those disasters.
Yeah, and let's talk about the work that you do now then with athletes and people in the football industry as well. What are some of the challenges, that the most common ones, I suppose, that crop up when it is these kind of young people that are in the sport that you talk to?
Well, they're very familiar to if you like, what everyday people kind of, you know, go to therapy for.
I think that surprises people though, because people probably think they're kind of untouchable a lot of the time, don't they? Like these footballers, especially like when they are on a huge international stage, they probably don't think that, a lot of people don't think that they have the same struggles as us, but of course they are just human, aren't they?
Not just humans, so they suffer from anxiety and depression and addiction and trauma and bad relationships, same as any of us. Maybe they're concerned about injury and they're concerned about their career. Well, most people who've got jobs anyway are worried about that, about losing their job. So that's a way for an athlete, you know, getting injured. I'm sure we'll talk about Riley in a bit, but you know, it's that kind of thing. So, but everybody has the anxieties. Maybe performers suffer more from performance anxiety, and they find their kind of joy and their lust for life in their activity that they do in their sport or in their performance on stage. I think that the performing arts and sports are very similar in the sense that it's about preparation, it's about rehearsal, it's about, you know, when the red light goes on, when you move across the white line and that's it, boom, showtime. You know, it's all built for that, and you have to perform. If you don't perform, boom, you lose your job and you get chucked out. Within that, I think a lot of performers don't want to alert the powers that be, if you like, to any kind of weakness. And if they're showing that I'm not feeling great about this, I'm anxious about this, I'm depressed about that, that they'll get dropped and they'll get kind of discarded. That might be something that's happening in their performance, in their sport, but it might be also outside stuff that's happening to them, you know, in their life, their relationship with a partner or debt or, you know, family life, losing a grandparent or a pet or anything that will affect you. Outside influences, you know, people don't think about that when they think about sports. It's like, why isn't he performing properly? Why isn't he doing this or that? Not known. And then also because of the pressure that a lot of performers are under, they're more susceptible to addictive behavior, to repetitive things, to imposter syndrome, all these things that will make them kind of then lose the focus, lose their kind of sweet spot, their mojo in their sport. And once that's lost, it's hard to kind of get it back if you don't have the right people to talk to and to work with.
Yeah, let's touch on Riley then. We had Riley Foster come in and chat to us and be really candid and open about everything that she's gone through and the injuries that she's sustained. Incredible person, incredible inspiration, and a lot of people have been following her story. So what's it been like working with her and such a positive person, really, considering everything that she's gone through in the last couple of years?
Riley's an incredibly positive person. I haven't spoken to her since 2022, but I worked with her very early on. I can't tell you anything about what we talked about, but I've spoken to Riley, and Riley said it's okay for me to say that I was her therapist. So I worked at the club, got me involved with her very early on. She'd only just had the halo put on. So I didn't see her pre-halo. I saw her post-halo. And the halo, for people who don't know, is this big contraption that she had on her head that was literally drilled into her skull to keep her head straight and her neck straight, because she'd broken the first three vertebrae in her neck in a car crash. And the thing was, would she ever play again to start with? Would she ever walk again? You know, could she turn her head? They were talking about fusing her bones together and all sorts of things like this. As I understand it, she hasn't had any surgery apart from the placing of the halo. So she's actually got through this. Her body has actually repaired itself. I think a lot of that as well is down to a positive mind, a great attitude that she had, a belief that she would recover. Her love for Liverpool and for football is amazing. She's a real great person to work with, positive person to work with. But yeah, it was, to start with, was working with her. It was, okay, what if you don't play again? What if you don't do this again? What her hopes and dreams were. And she was always of the thing of, I will get back, I will rehab, I will move, you know. And it was about breaking it down to stages, to, well, let's get you to the next stage, let's get you to the next stage, let's get you to the next stage. So, yeah, she's in rehab, I think, in Liverpool, but I haven't spoken to her for months, so I don't know quite where she is right now.
Yeah, she seems to be doing really well. I think she's, from the photos and videos I've seen, back doing goalkeeping drills and getting back in the swing of things. So it's great to see.
And she's still at the club anyway, isn't she, at the moment? So that's great.
Yeah, exactly. And a final thing I want to kind of touch on with you is, do you think with the media attention that there is now around, I guess it's kind of two sides of it, isn't there? Because more media means there is more attention on these players, and that means that from social media side of things, they get a lot more criticism, they're able to see a lot more, they're able to read a lot more about themselves. So that's kind of the bad side of it. But on the flip side, there is a lot more attention now on mental health of anyone, whether it's athletes, whether it's performers, like you mentioned, people you work with. How do you kind of see that shaping over the next few years? And do you think things are moving on a positive trajectory?
I think they are. I think things are improving. I think it's fantastic that Ben Chilwell talking recently about the, you know, troubles he's had, injury, and about getting back to where he wanted to be, getting back in the England team now as well. You know, it's hopefully people are a little bit more open to the thing of, okay, we can be anxious, we can be depressed, we can be addicted to things, we can, you know, have things like PTSD and still kind of come back and play. And we're all human. So, you know, the more they have people like me working within clubs, they don't normally have people like me working in clubs because players are suspicious of being too open with people in the clubs. So, you know, if you've got, you know, back in the past, I think people have their own kind of self-care stuff. People have masseurs and their own chefs and their own strength and conditioning coaches and all of these things, and the clubs are happy with that. Now I think much more of that is in club. It'd be great if they had therapists in club as well, but, you know, if we tend to see people, PFA and all of these things, outside of the clubs. Clubs don't know that they're seeing a psychotherapist. That's okay as well. So, if there's any footballers listening, yes, please get in touch with people like me and work with us outside of the club if you don't want, you know, your manager or you know, people to be alerted to what's going on personally for you.
Well, brilliant. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. I feel like we could go on, but we have lots of some kind of specials around these topics, so we will get you back on to chat again soon. But yeah, Trevor, thanks very much for talking to us, and I'll hand back over to Neil now.
This is Andy Heaton for Tour Live. I'm delighted to be joined by Dave from the Ragamuffins, just have a little chat about an event that he's participating in at the weekend at the Flurry. Sport fan support and food banks. Dave is a longtime friend of Anfield Rap. But we haven't, as it turns out, I don't think we've had a chat on a show for a while, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Yeah, you know, obviously a lot going on with the Ragamuffins in different guises and with the Soul Band as well. So obviously that's what we're doing this weekend. So a lot of people might know me from the stuff with the Ragamuffins, especially the Liverpool stuff we do. But I sing for a Northern Soul Band. And obviously the Ragamuffins, a lot of the kind of music that we initially started with is quite Northern Soul based, with all the kind of brass and the stuff going on.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about the event and then what it's for? I'm familiar with it, and I'm sure like those of our listeners will be, but for those who aren't familiar with it, can you give us just a little bit of a timeline of what the event's about, what it's supporting, the work the Band Support and Food Banks does for the region, and why events like this are hugely important.
Okay, well, yeah, well, this is specifically run by the Flurry and people like Timo, who obviously everyone's going to be very familiar with on the Anfield Rap, and obviously involved in Boss Nights and everything, and he's one of the former, basically the guy at the Flurry, and we've put on this event. They've put on this event called Food Aid. To not only raise money and get food donations for food banks across Liverpool, but to raise awareness of food poverty, especially predominantly in Liverpool, but obviously raise awareness of like the pretty dire situation across the country at the minute. And obviously, there's lots of musicians involved. This is specifically a tribute show, but we've got some very interesting acts. I mean, I'd like to think we're one of them, because while we are, especially the Northern Soul Chain, I suppose, is a tribute act to some of the great sort of Northern Soul artists, we try and do everything. Everything's completely 100% live with the big brass section. We've also got Michael Head and the Red Elastic Band. Obviously, people might know, if you're not familiar with Michael Head, I'm sure you'll be familiar with Shaq and the records they put out. And they're doing a tribute to the Love Forever Changes record, which obviously is like a Scouse musical bible, really. So that's going to be so popular. He's actually doing two performances over the course of the day to make sure as many people, if not everyone who goes to the festival, is going to get a chance to see that.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about Michael. I mean, the fact that you're involved and all that's brilliant. And I was only reading up on it later, and I've seen tickets have sold out. We'll get onto that in a minute. But Michael to actually do two sets is massive. And for those that don't know, I think Michael was, and I'm paraphrasing now, David, you'll know, so correct me if I'm wrong, he was described by NME as the greatest songwriter of his generation a couple of years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, well, even last year he had a number one record, and I think I've got a feeling I think it was Q Magazine that gave him Album of the Year, which is phenomenal. So for us to be playing, I mean, for me personally to be playing directly before him is quite an honor, to be quite honest. So, yeah, certainly that one's a tick off the sort of bucket list, really.
So, and you've actually got a long relationship with the Flurry. And I know that, you know, Tim Owen, you know, everyone in Liverpool music scene loves, you know, Mick Head and that. And, you know, his own journey, if you had not to use X Factor speak, but,
yeah,
you know, where how he's kind of come on in the last couple of years. And, you know, it feels like a very Liverpool thing to do, without sounding all flowery with the giving back and all that. But, yeah, you know, you're talking about a guy who doesn't have to do it, neither do yourselves. But, you know, it's such a massive event. I mean, Mick himself could sell events. He sells the O2 over and over to dedicate this and do this. And as you mentioned, Timo was such, put so much of his life.
It's phenomenal.
Into this and the Flurry. So I was going to ask you about the Flurry and why I do know, but for those who don't, why is it so special to you personally?
It's got a real, I hold it very, you know, very dear in my heart. So a couple of years ago, the best avenue for us to get music on, especially onto national radio, was through sending stuff to Janice Long. So whenever we had a new record out, the first person I'd send it to before we sent it to Radio 1 or before we sent it to BBC Introducing was we'd try and send it to Janice. And over time, I kind of got to know Janice. And ultimately, she asked us as the Ragamuffins to play at her wedding at the Flurry. And that was the last time I got to play on the stage, which is now actually named after her, because obviously, sadly, she passed on Christmas Day in 2021. So it's going to be quite emotional, to be quite honest, because I've not played there. Obviously, it's not playing with the Ragamuffins, as you know, but it's going to be like an emotional one, kind of setting foot on that stage and playing there. But the support that the Flurry kind of gives within the community. I mean, obviously the guitar club and the records they set the other day. I mean, the fact that you've got a guy who's played to 250,000 people on 2 days running at Nebworth, turning up to play acoustic guitar with people on a Tuesday night, just shows the breadth of the appeal that the place has, and it's phenomenal.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, yeah, it's just, see, there's so many kind of community-led events that Timo champions, but he's not the only one at the Flurry. It's a force of nature.
No, 100%. So for those who are lucky enough to get it, because I did mention it, so that what can we expect from yourselves on the night? I know you said it's a covers band, but for, you know, talk us through the whole event.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously you've got loads and loads of different bands, so whatever kind of music you're in, you're probably going to find something that you like. But I think everyone who's going to be going knows that anyway. So you've got everything from an Oasis covers band. You've got Ed Sheeran. You've got Adele. I think there's a Queen tribute band, obviously.
Just to be clear, it's not the actual Adele.
I mean, you know, we've been waxing lyrical about Mick Head like for like the last 5 minutes, and then you've got Adele turning up just out of the blue. Yeah, she's doing a little bit as well. But yeah, so you've got all these sort of tribute acts. The one we're doing, so I play for nine, as well as the Ragamuffins, I play for this nine-piece Northern Soul band, and they'd been going for about 10 years before I joined. But obviously, like I said, I've always liked my Northern Soul music, and they've never ever played in Liverpool. And obviously, when I started playing for them, I was like, why aren't we doing gigs in Liverpool? And so, got in touch with the Flurry and inquired about this event. And they said, well, I've got like a band who do a really, you know, we do well, but we're doing everything over this, do kind of loads of festivals and things like that over the summer, that we played with the Coral the other year. And it's, so yeah, all kind of get suited and booted. We've got a four-piece brass section, and full sort of like keys and everything, and just play all these sort of big Northern Soul tunes, like, you know, the Frankie Valli stuff, all the like Frank Wilson, all those sort of things. And it always comes across really well with like festival audiences. So we'll see how we go down.
Are you excited about it? I mean, I know the backstory with Janice and one thing and the other, but, you know, the event itself and what it's for and, you know, as I said, excited, like, how much energy have you got going into it? Because it must be brilliant for you.
Do you know what? This band always feels like, because obviously you do so much with one band, and from the moment I started playing with them, it just kind of like opens your eyes to a completely different thing, playing with different people. So it's always fun, like seeing these guys as well. When we get together and get together for gigs, and obviously when we get to do an event like this, it's just brilliant. I mean, you see an event sold out. Those words, wherever you're playing, always look good. And when it's, you know, when you know it's going to be a really good crowd who are in a really good frame of mind. You know, hopefully we'll come on stage after Liverpool have smashed Manchester City on Saturday as well. So, you know, we'll see how we go on in there. So, and it's going to be fantastic.
Tell me a bit about, just wave that a little bit. Tell me a little bit about what the Ragamuffins are up to and anything new going on and, you know, what you've been up to lately. I mean, I've seen mentioned there's been a bit of a bump in the Firmino track that you put out.
Yeah, so obviously it's going to be going on for 4 years since we put Si Señor out. But obviously, whenever something significant happens with us as a club, and specifically when anything happens with Firmino as a player, you see the little spike in the stats. I mean, obviously, as the head honcho at the Anfield Rap, you'll see that whenever something goes positively for the club, you'll be looking at the analytics and you're like, Jesus Christ, and you just see like a huge jump in something. And obviously you have things like you can keep track of your downloads and things like that. So the week when he obviously announced that he was going to be leaving in the summer, and obviously was immediately followed by us beating Man United 7-0. And so the leap in downloads was just, I think you get the little percentage things and it was just crackers, but it kind of sustained throughout the whole week. And obviously whenever it ticks over a certain number of streams or a certain number of downloads and there's enough in the pot, we send that over to the fan support and food banks guys. We have done that for the last couple of years. So there's obviously that. I think we're going over to do we're doing Glastonbury again this year. And then I think I'm going over to Holland. I'm going over to the Netherlands to do an event for the supporters club over there, which is going to make me very popular with my wife, kind of going from the biggest party on earth to, you know, probably the biggest party town in Europe. So, I might be looking for a divorce lawyer soon, Andy. But and then later on in the summer, we're going over to Norway with Jamie and with Keo. So that's going to be great fun. I think George Sefton's on his way over there as well, and that's for like a big Liverpool festival, which should be an absolute blast. So yeah, we'll be doing that in August as well. But yeah, we're working on a new record at the minute, and our trumpet player Florin has just become a dad this week, and he's caused a massive power struggle in the band because he's named his little boy after our bassist Alex and not me. So, you know,
egos everywhere.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, I'm honestly, congratulations to him and everything, and So he's going to be, I'm glad he's put his trumpet parts down already, because he's going to be out of action for the next couple of weeks.
I was going to say a couple of sleepless nights. No, mate, it's brilliant. I'm made up to hear that you're so busy and still going strong, because it's been going a while now.
That's it. It's like longevity. You know, that's it. 4 years, the new 20 and all that.
I'm glad you said that, mate. I'm feeling it myself. So listen, as we said earlier at the top, the tickets for the Food Aid events at the Flurry have sold out. Reminds me of the old 5-1 adverts. Don't bother turning up. It's a seller. It's a lockout. But if you listen to this and do want to get involved and help out with the fundraiser, you can donate online. Is that right? Through the Flurry's website?
You can get through. If you go to the Flurry's website, I think off the top of my head, it's flurry.org, isn't it? I think really you, well.
There's a thing called Google, mate. Don't worry about it. People can get it.
Yeah, no, I heard about that. Yeah. So you can go with the Flurry, and I'm sure they'll certainly have like donation points on there, and yeah, like you say, any support would be massively appreciated.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I can confirm. I've got it in front of me now, but it is theflurry.org. So if you go on there, there's links there, and you can. And if you feel that you can, just please give what you can, because we all see the real effects that this can have on the local community, and obviously, you know, as a whole. But the fan support and food banks now has gone nationwide thanks to Ian Byrne, and it's turned into something that I always argue it. Fan support and food banks shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
It shouldn't exist. It shouldn't be there. And the fact that it is sad in itself, but it also shows the strength of community and, you know, what we can all achieve when we pull together. So, David, listen, thank you so much for that, mate. It's been good to catch up. I'm glad you're doing well. I'm gutted I can't get to the event myself. I couldn't even the name Andy Heaton from the Anfield Rap couldn't get guest list on it. So, Andy shows you. Kind of shows you the demand and the caliber of the event. So listen, thanks very much for that, Dave. Good luck, and I hope you smash it.
Cheers, mate. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Now back to the studio. Cheers, mate.
And back we are. Back we are. A pleasure to be back with Sean, with Robbie, and with Sean. Sean, for me, the first question for the manager across the next three, but also looking at Manchester City versus Liverpool, is looking after the squad, the midfield in particular. Saturday, Tuesday is, I think, his biggest challenge coming into this one. He's got the five subs. I think he will make full use of them, and Guardiola hasn't got a midweek game, but he's got to have one eye on, you know, the more winnable game of the two away games is Chelsea, but Liverpool will want to go into Manchester City as close to all guns blazing as humanly possible. He will need to have a sense as to what it is he's doing with his side, and especially, as I say, the middle of the park across the two games.
Yes, forgive me for repeating myself a little bit here for subscribers, because on the review show, we did like a preview of this week and we talked about this. Soon to be award-winning review, Rob Gutman. We are coming for you, Rob Gutman. So, yes, when you've got 3 days recovery, obviously it's not just the increase in muscle injuries that goes through the roof potentially, it's the actual just physical and mental intensity that's going to be a problem. As a perfect example, you don't have Joe Gomez near both of these fixtures. I wouldn't even have him, you know, you'd have to have him in the squad as a bit of cover, I guess. I think for Chelsea, they're two completely different tactical problems in a way, I think, for Liverpool. So I think Klopp, that helps Klopp a bit, because I think you can actually structure the two teams differently, let alone personnel. And as an example, Chelsea, I think, will follow what they did against Dortmund. One, because Potter's getting a bit of momentum up now, and also because they'll view us and Dortmund as not completely dissimilar styles on that basis. And therefore, against Chelsea, I think there's a strong argument. You go Joe Gomez at right back as an example, because of what they'll do with Chilwell in particular down that side, but they like to overload down there. It might be a game where you go four forwards, because of the way Chelsea can be counter-attacked against. They're very weak at set pieces at times. So playing Darwin as the nine with someone off him in the 10 makes a lot of sense to me against that Chelsea side. And you can probably move Enzo Fernandez around with a 10, which means Kovacic all of a sudden has a lot of ground to cover. So I would like to see Liverpool go 4-2-3-1 there. I would pick my Chelsea team on that basis, because then with what's been going on with Darwin, and I'm sure we all want to see him start, but in reality, I'd probably have Nunes on the bench for City. One, because I'd want him fresh up top against Chelsea to hurt them in the way of sort of surmise there. But also, I think for City, I've said before, we don't respect the 0-0 enough for me this season. And yeah, I really think in this game, for me, you know, it's crying out for Jota, Gakpo and Salah. I just think now, it enables Jota to talk Gakpo through, because Gakpo doesn't have the lived experience and the problem of dealing with what I believe is the best player in the world in his position, and that is Rodri. So I think that at least Gakpo, in terms of his physicality on paper, is a decent match in terms of wanting to put him in there. And I also think in terms of this City game as well, you do go strong as reference, but I think you have to go with the midfield, probably Fabinho, Milner as your two sixes in a way, even in a three-man midfield, because I just think you need Jordan Henderson. You've got to get Henderson and Fabinho, for me, on the pitch against Chelsea as fresh as you can. But with where we're at right now, you can't get away with not using them against City. Yeah. And therefore, I think Klopp has to prepare four subs. I think he'll only do three, but I would do four subs on the hour mark of both games. And I'd have my subs pre-planned and work through with the players all being well, because I think you can swap Fabinho and Henderson on 60 against City and then hopefully play them both at Chelsea. Because I do think with the loss of Thiago and Batsic on the left-hand side, in different ways, in that role, you've got to be able to switch the play. And one thing that Jordan Henderson does give us would be exceptional diagonal balls if he was to play the left-hand side of the midfield against Chelsea. And because you can counter-attack them, particularly with a back three, I think you have to start Fabinho and Henderson in those roles. And therefore, yeah, I'm kind of working backwards. I wouldn't be surprised if everyone's having kittens when the team news comes in, because I think it might be like... Yeah, because I think we'll be a Milner midfield, no Nunes, you know, that kind of a thing.
I think on it, Robbie, the idea of, I think the other thing as well is that you haven't got to see the idea of not starting someone as they're not going to be able to contribute. As Sean says there, you know, the idea of switching them on 60, the idea of being able to carry Nunes as a threat off the bench for a period of time in the game against City, I'm into it and I can see the argument for it big time. And I think there's a couple in there where we've got to not sort of view it in that way. I think there's ways and means. There's a couple of shouts. There's a shout or two for Curtis, and the idea of maybe Curtis getting a chance at City in the comments as we're going through this. And I don't think that's mad either. I take Sean's Milner point, but if the team dropped and it had Curtis Jones in it, I wouldn't go, this is I can't believe this is happening. I'd go, okay, let's see what the manager's got planned here, because I think that Liverpool, the idea of respecting the nil-nil, as Sean says, for me, part of that is if it's 0-0 on 60. In this game against Manchester City, I feel as though we're much more likely to win it when it's 0-0 on 3 minutes, if it's still 0-0 on 60, because they're the ones who are desperate for the points. And that can work in our favour. That pressure they're under at the top of the table, I think, can work in our favour at this one.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of, like, Sean's like comments about the selection in particular, I think they're really astute, because if it is 60, 70 minutes gone and it is 0-0, and the game is getting a bit more fraught, and there is element, and you know, we're a bit in it, and City are getting more desperate. Nunes missed 2 days of training this week, and they say he's fully fit, that he's available. But that point in the game, that's where someone like him will be at his mercurial best. If you want chaos in a game like that, which is going to become quite potentially quite stretched in the last 20 minutes, that's the ideal time to see a player like that. I think that Liverpool at the best. I know, like, we're always talked about for our attack, you know, our attack in football, but when we won the league, a lot of the games we win by a goal here or there. They were tight games and we were able to stay in them, and we were able to just hang with teams. You know, we'd hang with teams and we might give them a shot, you know, we might give them a goal, but we'd always hang with them and we'd grind them down to beat them. We were talking before about the experience in this Liverpool side. It's still there. Just something somewhere along the line has slipped. Now, we played City already this season. We beat them 1-0. And that was a close game. And for large periods of that game, they had the lion's share of the ball. They caused us problems. But we reverted to type. And we ground it out. With a wonderful goal by Salah, but we ground it out. And if I remember rightly, we scored there from... It was from a goal kick, weren't it?
Yeah,
it was not a goal kick, but Salah's kicked it out. I mean, Alisson's kicked it out of his hands, hasn't he? And Salah's turned it. So I think there's a blueprint for us to win here, and we've already executed it. Obviously, they're going to be aware of that. But as you point out, Neil, there's going to be a lot more passion flowing. Not more passion, but there's going to be they're going to be much more fraught with nerves because of what's at stake here. And I think we can definitely capitalise on that.
I feel, Sean, this season, sides have played game situations against us. I've had this thing where for the first 10, 15 games this season, we kick off as though we're 1-0 down because we're trying to win the league, and you know you've got to win every week. City kick off on this one with where the table is. Knowing that Arsenal are at home to Leeds at 3 o'clock, they kick off against Liverpool like they're 1-0 down. They need a goal from the minute they kick off. And I think we've got to be prepared, Sean, for me, for a really fast start. We've got to know they're going to try to absolutely come at us, I reckon. First 5-10 minutes, they're going to throw the kitchen sink at us. And we've got to be prepared for that. We've got to be prepared for soaking that up. when a couple of things go wrong, which they will, if the keeper digs us out or something like that, we've got to be prepared for setbacks. We've got to be prepared for the idea that this is going to be a rough football match where they're going to be absolutely at it from the first minute.
Yeah, just about taking the sting out of the game any given moment, whether it's the crowd or the ref or just slowing the tempo down or whatever we need to do that first 10 or 15 minutes. We can be, yeah, you're right, this is the first game in, God, since I can remember in recent history with City where we can be more conservative. You know, I think we need the points, but we don't, you know, we can survive without them and probably still get top four. And we don't have to play a perfect game. Whereas for so many years, we've gone into this game thinking every inch of that pitch has got to be perfect. And I think, you know, even if you're looking at the record that City have had against us at home, probably in the last few seasons, there has been quite a few goals in it. I think the average is about 2.5 goals at least in 8 of their last 9 home matches against us. So, yeah, I'm happy for us to just dog out a 0-0. I really don't need to see beautiful football whatsoever. I don't think we will see Nunes start if he's not trained much this week and Diaz. So yeah, I just want us to ride out the pressure and not really look rattled.
With them, Sean, I think that the manager wouldn't feel it was the end of the world if there was no Haaland, in a really weird way. Probably more so, he'd probably rather have Haaland from Southampton away than Liverpool at home, because it allows him leeway to make a decision between Alvarez or a false nine. Maybe be able to introduce Haaland and Alvarez from the bench if he starts with a false nine and give us something else to think about as the game wears on. For me, the key thing is we've got to be prepared. The manager talked today about the thing about prepping for Haaland as you try to stop the final pass. That's the thing. And we still want to try and stop the final pass. For me, I don't want the paucity of his ambitions there. We need to get around Rodri. Rodri's the one we need to get around. We've got to make Rodri's afternoon as difficult as possible. So I think that they'll be all right with no Haaland. They really will. They'd rather have him right for Southampton than in the Bayern Munich game. But we need to be absolutely honest with how they like to play out at the minute with Rodri, with Stones coming in from certain angles, with the fact that they'll drop Silver in and a false nine. They'd love that as well. We've got to be on top of how they move the ball through the middle of the pitch.
Yes, the other thing that City will be desperate for fast start-wise is that they play Arsenal at the end of the month, but Arsenal play 4 league games, City only play 3. Now, that's why it's for another show, but Arteta, for me, has to come to Anfield and not be kamikaze. But at some point, he needs to try and win that game of football. And I think he needs to risk a point if it's second half to get 3. Because if they can go to City with an 11-point lead, albeit with games in hand, because Arsenal have got, I think, United. They've got Chelsea, I think, after that game.
Yeah.
Reason I say that's relevant is I don't think Guardiola can wrap Haaland completely up in cotton wool on this unless the game's done. And therefore, I think he's going to be desperate for him to come out the blocks fast, especially when you've had an international break, because it's easier to drop down the gears than it is to move up them when you've had a break like this. The Rodri thing, yeah, if you can, it's weird because when City are building, it sounds bizarre. I think you've got to risk screening him in front. I think Tottenham have done a really good job of trying to force City to play away from Rodri, and then when they do use him, they nab it off him. And I think they've got Conte's really good at laying traps without the ball. And I think Tottenham are as good as anyone on that. And you'd like to think we haven't had enough time on it. That's one problem. But you'd like to think hopefully there's enough time for Liverpool to look at them videos and lay a bit of a Rodri trap. And I don't mean that against him. I mean, you lay it for the basis of they can't push through anywhere else. And if you can nab it in between them lines there, you're right at them like Tottenham approved. The way to get at this City is to switch it, and you've got to try and switch it past Rodri. So you've got to attack down one flank. We always say switching and flanks as if it's like a defensive thing. I mean, you've got to attack through one side of their midfield, and you've got to switch it in midfield because you're at them then. He can't deal with that. He covers so much ground through his reading of the game that you can't just go, oh, well, we're in behind their 8 or their fullback that's tucked in to make it. You know, you've got to be very cute about the way you switch the play in the midfield area. That sounds weird. That's why I think you have to go with a Milner at one side of Fabinho, because that De Bruyne role, you've got to stop that zone in front of Van Dijk in an area where Van Dijk doesn't want to go in there. Robertson can't go in there. it's got to be a midfielder in there that's going to be an absolute warrior for you and close them spaces down. And I think you can get away with a Harvey Elliott then, where you can say, listen, your job is to do what I've just referenced. You've got to be a bit risky in the right place. You've got to suck a few players over and release other players in midfield, and we can get at them on that basis. And I would have Milner going down in the first minute with arthritis, the second minute with a knee bang, the third minute with a big toe problem. I think he's got every right to say to the ref, look at the age of me, the games I've played. Like, I can't. Liverpool, like Sean was saying, we don't have to go into this going, oh, we need 3 points to get past them in the race for the title or whatever. Liverpool can be all the dark arts. My fear is that I don't think Liverpool have any interest in dark arts. I think Liverpool have got, it's more likely that we go, this is a free hit. Let's make this a roller coaster and go for it. Because if Liverpool can keep it tight for the first 20 here, at some point, City have to go for it. And yep. Liverpool's best chance of winning the game increases on the break, especially if you've got Darwin on the bench to bring on and players like that.
I think our chance increase the more emotional they get. I think we've seen that so many times. We've got to make them emotional, haven't we, Robbie? We've got to find a way to make them emotional, and then we can find a way through this one. We've got to get their emotions to a certain pitch. We've had this used against us this season, and that's why I'm with Sean on the time wasting. I'm happy to have a roller coaster, but I wouldn't mind 10 minutes of winding Rodri up now off the back of what he said after the Scotland game. You know what I mean? I'm fine. Let's find ways to absolutely get in their heads first 10, 15. Remember, it's a game. Do their heads in. And then when the time's right, go up. If you want to go mad, Liverpool, go mad when the time's right and make them emotional.
Man City aren't that dissimilar to us in that they will take their lead from their manager. If his head goes, theirs will. It's as simple as that. If you can get into his head and he's throwing fingers to the fucking sky on the touchline and running up and down, like kicking off, it will feed onto the pitch. It'll feed into the stands. And I know that stadium in particular, like, don't get me wrong, I think it gets a bit like a bit of an unfair rep sometimes for the atmosphere. However, they will get on their backs. If they don't think that City are performing well, they will get on the backs. And if there is 30, 40 minutes gone and City aren't like, they're frustrating them and we're frustrating them, the stands will be, you know, there'll be groans from the stands. It will feed in, and we can do, you know, we can definitely capitalise on that. We can capitalise on that. Liverpool in the past, I know I've said it numerous times, but we have been canny. It's like this season, you know, you've got to hope that it's a kind of, it's a bit of an anomaly and something somewhere's just gone wrong. But historically, we have been a canny football team under Jurgen Klopp. We have used our notes. And I take Sean's point about we've never been a team to fully subscribe to the dark arts. And I think the reason we don't is because we've never had to. We've never had to because we've just our game craft's so good. You know, do you know what I'm saying? And if we can just keep our heads about us, and just keep them at arm's length, and to use the boxing analogy, keep them at the end of our jab, then we can win.
All right, I'm gonna ask all three of you for a prediction. But first and foremost, Sean, I just support 0-0 at half time. That's what I support. Liverpool Football Club, no. 0-0 at half time is a concept I support in this one. Respect the 0-0 and respect the horribleness of it.
I'll go for 1-1.
You'll go for 1-1. Okay. Predict anything you want, Sean.
We'll get beat, but I think we win the next two.
There we are. All right. Robbie, you can predict anything you want.
I'm going to go for a 1-0 Liverpool.
1-0 Liverpool. All right, then. Excellent stuff across the board from Sean, from Sean, and from Robbie O'Neill. When the manager first turned up, he said, what are we going to do when we play against better sides? He said, we're going to drag them down to our level and kill them. I'd like a big ball of that on Saturday morning. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be an absolute thriller in every single way, genuinely. I can't. Let's not pussyfoot around this. I've had enough messing about. I am absolutely in for a massive Liverpool week. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much to Harriet and Andy for speaking to guests in the mid part there. Thank you very much indeed to Sean, to Robbie, and to Sean as well. It's a big Saturday morning for everyone. I, for one, cannot wait. Sports Social Podcast Network.